Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Food and race intersect in so many ways, revealing much about who we are and where we come from. Historian Jessica Harris takes us along on her food journey from Africa to America. Civil rights activist Rudy Lombard remembers the childhood experience that propelled him to a lunch counter sit-in, precipitating the end of segregation in Louisiana. Then, we'll hear the story of Billy Carpenter, a young white home economist of the 1950s who stood up for her black co-workers' rights in the workplace. You won't want to miss a minute of this week's Louisiana Eats. The sit-in at McCrory's lunch counter on September 10, 1960, began a wave of action that ended segregation in New Orleans restaurants. Rudy Lombard was then a senior at Xavier University, leader of the local chapter of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and a Freedom Ride organizer. Recently, Dr. Lombard shared previously untold tales of those days. Now, take us back to those days of the lunch counter sit-ins. What propelled you into action?
I think for me, my mother cooked for one of the wealthy families in New Orleans. It was the Stewart, John Stewart family. They lived on the corner of Dryads and Napoleon, across the street from one of the better-known restaurants, Manali's. And when I was a kid, I used to accompany my mother to work. But I was curious as hell about what went on at Manali's. And sort of resolved that one of these days I was going to go in that restaurant. And I knew then, as a kid, that blacks were not allowed to go.
What was Lombard versus Louisiana, and how did that turn out?
Well, the Lombard case came out of a sit-in we did at McCrory's. Myself, Oretha Haley, Lanny Goldfinch, and Cecil Carter. That was the second week of some sit-ins we were doing on Canal Street. They accused us of criminal trespassing and so forth and so on. And the case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And my name got attached to the case that involved the other students and myself. There were five cases that were heard at the same time. And the ruling was that it was unconstitutional to discriminate against people on the basis of race in a place of public accommodation. So it made it possible for blacks and whites to go to the same places, restaurant, hotels, whatever, whatever.
So what happened? What happened when you all went in and took
the
case?
They asked us to leave, and when we refused, they arrested us. The difference in the situation that we participated in was that the mayor insisted that blacks not be served in those places of public. And as a result, ultimately, the United States Supreme Court said, well, this wasn't an issue of private property, because if the mayor insisted that the local codes be enforced, which were not on the books so much, but it was the tradition of not serving blacks and whites in places of public accommodation. The fact that he insisted on us being arrested and being denied service made it a case that took it out of the realm of, say, private property and made it a public action. So his involvement made it such that the court ruled this was not an issue of public accommodation, but state action in effect.
Well, one place where I know that you were always welcome was at Dookie Chase Restaurant.
Absolutely.
And I have heard tell of many tales of the infamous upstairs room at Dookie Chase Restaurant. And could you tell me what was going on up there?
Well, when the Civil Rights Movement came along, the whites who participated in the Civil Rights Movement would go to Dookie Chase and enjoy a meal along with the blacks. And the police never bothered us at Dookie's. So we always knew that Dookie would be a refuge for whatever it is we were involved in. And we got the support of the Chase family to do that.
Now, Leah tells me, you know, a lot of people don't seem to remember that it was just as illegal for white people to eat in black restaurants as it was for black people to eat in white restaurants. And
absolutely.
And yet somehow Dookie Chase was the place where everybody came together to find that common working ground that we moved forward on. Yeah. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I can tell you it was true, and I can tell you it was illegal. But I think a lot of white politicians ate in private parties at Dookie Chase. So she knew a lot of them. And they could never do it in public with a group of black men and women. Blacks and whites were always welcome at Dookie Chase, no matter how radical it was perceived by the general public and the politicians and the civil authority of the city and the state and so forth. It didn't matter to them. They were stand-up kind of people. Now, there also was a woman working at Dookie's by the name of Virgie Castle, and she did the same thing. She had blacks and whites who came to her house to eat and, in many cases, to stay there if we couldn't find a place for them to live while they were involved with the Freedom Rides or anything else we did. So between, you know, the Castles, Leah and her family, that was our sanctuary for me long before the 60s, but from the 60s onward.
Rudy, how were you involved with the Freedom Riders?
Well, I was a national officer of the Congress of Racial Equality, national vice president. So I was involved in the planning of the Freedom Rides. And that was really the second Freedom Ride. In 1947, there was a ride sponsored by CORE called the Journey of Reconciliation. And that was an attempt to test whether or not the United States government and the United States Supreme Court had implemented a decision in a case called the Irene Morgan case. Irene Morgan case in the early 40s was about a black woman who refused to give up her seat in interstate travel. They arrested Irene Morgan. Her case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And the court ruled that discrimination, racial discrimination in interstate travel was unconstitutional. So in 61, the Congress of Racial Equality decided to plan a second Freedom Ride. So I was involved in the planning at the national level. And, you know, I think at least 40% of the Freedom Riders in the second wave came through New Orleans, which is an untold story. When the bus was bombed in Anniston, Alabama, and the mob attacked the initial Freedom Riders in Montgomery, those rides were aborted, and they flew all those people here. And we didn't have enough houses for them to stay in. So we put a lot of them up at St. Michael's Dormitory on the campus of Xavier University. And that's a story that most people don't know about.
That was Dr. Rudy Lombard sharing Dookie Chase reminiscences and other stories of the civil rights movement. You're listening to Louisiana Eats. Now it's time for our Louisiana Eats Culinary Quiz Question of the Week, brought to you with support from French Market Coffee. The correct answer to last week's question, which barnyard animal does Emil DeFelice raise at his South Carolina farm, Caw-Caw Creek, is pig. Happy pigs if they're Emil's pigs. Now, let's see who this week's lucky winner is. Thomas Walsh, our Louisiana Eats producer, is manning the grinder.
This week's winner actually has a familial connection to Caw-Caw Creek. His brother-in-law works as a chef in the same town as the farm and uses their product on a regular basis. So thanks to Chris Williams of New Orleans, Louisiana, for not only participating in our contest, but for sending us your personal story. Follow in Chris's footsteps this coming week for your chance to win.
our lucky winner will be receiving 3 full-size bags of French Market coffee, including dark roast with chicory, and French roast. This week's question is, what is the name of the smiling baker found on every Hubig's pie bag? Email your answers to LouisianaEats at WWNO.org by midnight Sunday night. All correct answers received will be mixed together in our French Market coffee grinder, and one lucky winner will be chosen at random and announced on next week's show. Again, this week's question is, what is the name of the smiling baker found on every Hubig's pie bag? Email those answers by midnight Sunday night to Louisiana Eats at WWNO.org with culinary quiz in the subject line, and you could be next week's lucky winner. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. 11 cookbooks have preceded Dr. Jessica Harris's High on the Hog. In each of the acclaimed previous books, Jessica revealed something new about the African diaspora from a culinary point of view. Now she takes us on the culinary journey from Africa to America. Jessica, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you.
High on the Hog. Explain that term.
Okay, it goes back to plantation humor. And actually, there were a series of trickster tales that grew out of plantation humor and that had to do with the master and John, who would have been the enslaved person, so that at hog killing time, Massa would come down to the cabins and say, come on, John, it's hog killing time. You're going to come and help me kill the hog, and I'm going to give you the head and the tail and the feet and the innards. And John said, yes, Massa. And that went on for years. And then one day John got his own hog. Then he got another hog. And that winter, when Massa came down to the quarters at hog killing time and said, John, come on down, I'm going to kill the hog. And John sort of said, I don't rightly think so, Massa. I've got my own hog now. And I'm eating backbone and middling. I'm eating pork chops and bacon. I'm eating ham. I'm eating high on the hog. Not the feet, but the ham.
You know, we all grew up with the Gone with the Wind images, you know? And the part of Gone with the Wind in the very beginning where Mammy's lacing Scarlet up and telling her you can't be eating like a pig when you get to that social event. And would you explain how that could have been Mammy's actual idea?
African-American women particularly have raised generations. And the thing that I loved about that was I found an article by Miss Manners. And she says, in Star Spangled Manners, a book that she wrote, she talks about the Southerners, and particularly the white Southerners, and says, and I'm quoting from her here, Southerners were learning to practice African manners. It is not from the British that what came to be known as Southern graciousness was developed, with its open, easygoing style, its familial use of honorifics, and its y'all come to see us hospitality. The higher the Southern family's pretensions, the more likely the children were to be receiving daily etiquette instruction from someone whose strict sense of the fitting came from her own cultural background, the house slave.
I was fascinated with your tales of Philadelphia. I had no idea that the term caterer was a modern term, and I loved how you tied it all back to Robert Bogle.
Okay, well, I don't know that caterer is such a modern term in that sense, but what Bogle meant as he became a caterer was incredible. And Bogle was someone who may have been enslaved, and he gets to Philadelphia, and Philadelphia at that point in time no longer had slavery. But as it was moving from enslavement, one of the things that happened was the wealthy families, if they were not wealthy enough to have a household of servants, then could rent a butler. And so Bogle took this job and then in the course of his developing this job became a caterer. And he became a caterer to the wealthy of Philadelphia, up to the point where, if you know the sort of the Philadelphia names, the Biddles are the very, you know, summum of society. And so Biddle wrote an ode to Bogle. And Biddle's ode to Bogle basically talks about how a child is not considered properly christened, a person is not considered well dead and buried, a wedding is not considered to have taken place and been sanctified unless Bogle is there to take care of it.
I was shocked to learn that the Haitians had such a Philadelphia influence as well.
Oh, absolutely. They came to Philadelphia in great numbers. And as they come into that mix, they get into the catering business. And so they then take these ideas formulated by Bogle and manage to move them forward because they have families of caterers. And then they began to virtually share opportunities, share equipment, so that each family didn't have to have tables. They had a warehouse in which every family needed them could get tables, could get chairs, could get all of the equipment that was a part of that catering process. And so as such, what they managed to do was then take generations and certainly families of newly arrived Haitians, but also of African-American Philadelphians, and bring them out of poverty using their catering skills.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to come and talk with us today.
Well, thank you for your friendship, my dear.
Jessica Harris, culinary historian and author of High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. Rode New Orleans buses or streetcars at any time during the 20th century, you probably read Nopcey's Rider's Digest. And if you're like me, you saved him for the recipes. Over a 20-year time span, a group of more than 60 home economists, under the direction of Vivian Berry, developed and demonstrated those recipes at the company's headquarters on Barone Street. Those were very different times than we live in today. Billy Carpenter is here with us to talk about life in late 1950s New Orleans. Billy, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy.
So, Billy, where were those recipes created?
In an upstairs test kitchen. It was on the 8th floor. Our office was on the 2nd floor, and there was a test kitchen on the 8th floor at Nopcey on Barone Street.
So back in those days, where did the groceries come from?
We had some things that we bought by the cases that came in from wholesalers, but on the day-to-day, the fresh produce, the last-minute things came from Solari's. And wonderful, wonderful grocery store in the French Quarter, which I wish still existed.
So they delivered?
They delivered it on their bicycle.
So who was working with you up in the kitchen?
Usually Alberta and Octavia, the two black ladies who were assigned just to the home service department, knew a lot about cooking, probably more than any of us did, and helped us with wonderful suggestions. And they wouldn't tell us what to do. They would just make subtle suggestions of
so
a better way.
What were their jobs?
Their job, they were behind the scenes whenever we were doing a food demonstration, and everything was set up on trays, and they would set up all of the trays, everything that you needed for each dish that was going to be prepared, and as the time came for you to present that and to do basically your sales pitch, they would pass those trays out to you, and then you would pass the dirty ones back to them. They were there with us. One or the other of them was with us all the time. If we did a nighttime demonstration, they were there with us. And then at that time, they would stay, and we would prepare a dinner for the two of us that we would eat in our little back kitchen.
They were there doing the chopping and
yes.
doing the cleaning up.
Yes. They chopped and they washed.
So at the end of the day, sometimes you all would sit down and eat together?
We did, and we had, I have some memories about that of things that would not occur now. At one point in time, I was sitting at the table upstairs eating dinner with, I don't recall if it was Alberta or Octavia, one of the two. And a gentleman who was, I'm not sure if he was the vice president or whatever. Anyway, he was much over us, walked through the kitchen and did not like what he saw. So the next day, we got the word that we were not to sit at the table with them to eat. So to circumvent that little ruling, from then on, we just stood up to eat our dinner.
In this time period that we're talking about, the buses and the streetcars were mm-hmm. segregated then, too.
Exactly.
And how did that work?
Well, it was the back-to-the-bus routine that we're all familiar with, but that was strictly for the seating that there was segregation. If the buses or the streetcar was crowded, which they very often were, everybody stood together, and it did not matter if you were standing next to two black people or whatever. It was not segregated at all. However, when the bus stopped, the white people got off on the front. Our black friends got off to the rear. And it was just beyond our ability to insult those ladies by not sitting down with them. And that's what I felt like it would be.
Yeah, it would be disrespect.
Mm-hmm. It would be.
Thank you so much for telling us your story.
Well, thank you, Poppy. Thank you so much for having me.
Billy Carpenter, NOPC home economist and quiet civil rights crusader. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, author Kit Wall on 25 years of America's best of the best chefs, the James Beard Top Award winners.
I learned that each one of these chefs were completely different because of their time and place and what drove them to cooking and their passion, but really their fundamental insistence on detail and consistency. They were tremendously committed to what they do.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from French Market Coffee and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan Steakhouse, Palace Cafe, and the Bourbon House, Lights Egan Funeral Homes, the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Foundation, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Cookin' Magazine. Thanks to Thomas Walsh, our associate producer and sound engineer. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.